Often we may tend to think that prophecy is something for the mind, but really the goal in our study of prophecy should be to find those applications in our lives, whether it is to develop Christian character or to direct our Christian activity. So that's what we really want to get out of it. And we're going to look at basically four different subtitles. We'll take a look at Joshua's last day at Jericho, or last week actually it would be, but we want to concentrate on the last day of the last week. And it arranges for us a picture of the gospel age and what's going on in the gospel age harvest, both. With the Exodus, then, we want to take a look at its seven last plagues, corresponding to those seven times around Jericho on the last day. And then to look at Revelation 16, those seven last plagues. And more important still is, what should we do about it? Well, the first thing that we want to look at is when Joshua came to Jericho. And we find at the beginning of that in Joshua chapter 6, Joshua rose early on the first day. Right away, we stop and think, wait a minute, Joshua. What's the Greek form of the word or name Joshua?
Jesus.
That's right. Joshua is an apt type of Jesus. And Jesus' resurrection began the gospel age of the church. Okay, now we note that after that, then the seven priests with the seven trumpets picked up the ark and marched around the city every day for 7 days, once each day, except seven times on the last day. Do we have any last day prophecies? The last day begins with, they rose early. What would that suggest to us? They, plural, if not the resurrection of the sleeping saints. The last day proceeds to a last blowing of the trumpet, and the wall falls down. This typifies Joshua is the Hebrew name for Jesus, and Jesus' resurrection begins the gospel age of the church. The gospel age is divided into seven periods of time. And the last day, beginning with Christ's return, which is not specifically shown here, begins with the resurrection of the saints who previously had fallen asleep in death. The last day is characterized by seven events. The last event is Armageddon, when the defenses of this present evil world collapse and Christ takes the city for 1,000 years. After that, Joshua's curse on the rebuilder of the city typifies Satan and the other incorrigible's destruction in the little season. Now, Jericho's last day is key to understanding about a third of the book of Revelation. We have the seven messengers with the seven trumpets, just like the seven priests with the seven trumpets at Jericho. And so, therefore, the seven messengers with the seven trumpets spans the gospel age. In fact, we should probably catch up here. So, we have not only the seven messengers with the seven trumpets spanning the gospel age, but we also have the seven messengers to the seven churches. And we have the seven seals. They also span the gospel age. And then, how about those seven times on the last day? The seven messengers pouring out the seven last plagues during the last day. So all put together, those chapters amount to about a third of the whole book of Revelation, being explained to us in just one chapter of the Old Testament, Joshua chapter 6. Now we go on to the Exodus. In the picture of the Exodus, Moses comes to Egypt, and the 10 plagues follow. Israel is released. Later, Pharaoh's Egyptians follow, and they are destroyed in the Red Sea. And Israel is then free from Egypt forever after. This type of Jesus' first advent to the end of the gospel age, even to Armageddon, the world's deliverance into the thousand-year kingdom of Christ, Satan's little season, and the ultimate deliverance of the world from sin and death. It's nicely summarized in the Studies in the Scriptures, Volume 6, Passover chapter. I see in my notes I mistakenly put in Volume 5, but it is Volume 6. I'll make a correction here. At the end, for those who would like the notes, they'll be on the table over there, and you need to make the correction from Volume 5 to Volume 6. Just the first two or three pages of the Passover chapter give us an overall picture. But now we'd like to refine it a little bit more, get a little bit more detail from the Exodus picture. The Exodus picture is one of the two longest types in the entire Bible. The other one has to do with Joseph in Egypt. Now, it's interesting to note, Moses doesn't administer the first three plagues in Egypt. Aaron administers them. In each case, it's, say unto Aaron, do this. Say unto Aaron, do that. Say unto Aaron, do the third thing. But at that, and the plagues fall on both the Israelites and the Egyptians until we get to Exodus chapter 8, and the Lord says, I will put a division between my people and thy people, that there be no more plagues in the land of Goshen where my people dwell. And from that point on, Moses takes the dominant role in administering the plagues, and they fall only upon the Egyptians. That typifies for us that Christ, at his return, separates the Lord's people. Come out of Babylon, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. That's Revelation 18, first five verses. Now then, It's a mouse trap, that's what it is. When we take a look then at the Exodus plagues, the last seven plagues, we see that we have first the plague of the flies. It's annoying, but it doesn't really kill anybody. Murrain came along and killed the cattle. That's a destructive plague. Then there came a boil that burst forth as flames on man and beast. Annoying, but it doesn't kill them. May make them wish that it had. But then came the hail with the lightning and the thunder and the fire. And it destroyed the first two crops of Egypt. That would be the barley and the flax, because they come up before the wheat and the spelt. I trust it's no different in Alberta and Saskatchewan. The next plague is also destructive. That east wind brought locusts into all the borders of Egypt, and it ate up the remaining crops after the wheat and the spelt had arisen. And that also can explain for us Pentecost. There was an offering of the first fruits in connection with the Passover lamb, and the Sunday after. And then 7 weeks later, day 50, again there was an offering of the first fruits, because the barley and the flax come up first, and later the wheat and the spelt come up. Barley is often used to picture our Lord Jesus, not the whole church. But the wheat is used to picture the whole church, so there is a reason for it. Both plagues were destructive, but the plague of the locusts was brought in by the east wind, and they were all driven out again by a mighty west wind. That was followed by a plague of darkness, thick darkness. Darkness so thick that no man could move from his place for 3 days. How would you like to have it so dark outside and you couldn't move? You wouldn't dare go out there. Probably because there was volcanic ash in the air for 3 days. You don't want to get that in your eyes, do you? So, the last of the seven last plagues in Egypt was the death of the firstborn. They were the heirs of the kingdom. Now, one thing we notice is since the 1870s, I'll back up just one moment. Think for a moment. The flood. I think probably many of us, maybe most of us, think that the flood was worldwide. I do myself. And what was the next major world event that could be called truly worldwide? Just a moment to think about it. There were plagues, but they were generally restricted to two or three continents at the worst. World War I was certainly a worldwide event. And I had supposed that was the first one because they never taught us about the Long Depression in school. But it started in 1873 and lasted a couple of decades. At the time, they called it the Great Depression. But then in the 1930s, they wanted that term for that depression, so they called the other one the Long Depression. The next major world event, World War I. Next major world event, the Great Depression, it too was worldwide. Brethren in Australia were among those that almost starved. It was worse there than it is here. It was here. And then we have a destructive plague. Number four, the hail with lightning, thunder, and fire that ran along upon the ground and destroyed the crops. That would correspond to World War II. What happened after World War II? Well, we saw that the communism started in the east, and it started blowing westward. There was no country that was not affected or influenced by them. We'll talk about that more another time. Now, I was aware of this back before 1960, and suppose that, if the mighty west wind was going to blow all the locusts out of Egypt again, that is, blow away the communist threat, it must be World War III. I will confess a mistake right there. What came instead was revolutions to show the West prevailing over the East. That would give us one more plague to go before Armageddon. And that's a plague of darkness, thick darkness that could that lasted for 3 days. Nobody could leave from his place during those 3 days. So it would suggest to me that since that is not a destructive plague, it probably means a financial collapse or a deep depression. Now, just a little aside, I'm not putting too much on it, but it lasted 3 days in Egypt. Does that suggest then that it will last for 3 years? I'll be kind of watching to see when the time comes. I'm not trying to bring down the financial system of the world, that we can watch as observers. And then the last plague, of course, the death of the firstborn, the death of the heirs of Satan's kingdom, the death of the heirs of this world will happen when this world implodes upon itself, and there will be nothing more for the heirs of this world to inherit. But the heirs of the Lord's people, the firstborn, the church of the firstborn, will be delivered. Now, Revelation chapter 16 also shows the seven last plagues, but from a different standpoint. The plagues of the Exodus seem to show us the events in the world, but those in Revelation seem to show what effects are intended to happen. The effects that they are planned on affecting this world, affecting the, what shall we say, particularly Christianity, organized Christianity. But I don't think we'll take time to talk about that further, because there are other things we do need to talk about. Another set of prophecies that show us what's going on in our time are found in Ezekiel chapter 37 and 38, maybe 39 also. Ezekiel 37 shows us the Valley of Dry Bones, the regathering of Israel to its land. Is that taking place now, in your lifetime and mine? Anybody have an idea what percentage of the world's Jews are already back in the land of Israel? Okay, in time it will be 70%. It's actually about 45% are already back. And why are not more already back? Because they're right here in the Americas, the United States, Canada, and Argentina. Those are the last three big concentrations of Jews that have not yet gone back to Israel. Now, Ezekiel 38 and 39 show us the Gog and Magog, the events bringing us up to Armageddon and including. And it's followed by nine chapters of Ezekiel's temple, showing us the kingdom. So the progression, it starts with the restoration of Israel, and then it brings us up to Armageddon, and after Armageddon, a lot more is said about Ezekiel's temple. So the last part of Ezekiel brings us from the time we are now living in right into the thousand-year kingdom of Christ and beyond. Now, the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc are each shown to us in Ezekiel chapter 38. The Bible used to have the 38th chapter in here. I'll go ahead and read the first few verses of chapter 38. And the word of Jehovah, this is from the American Standard Version, "And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face towards Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, prince of Rosh, or chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And I will turn thee about, and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all of thine army, horses and horsemen, and all of them clothed in full armor, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them handling swords. Persia, Cush, and put with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his hordes, the house of Togarma in the uttermost parts of the north, and all his hordes, even many peoples with thee." That's the Eastern Bloc. We drop down to verse 13, and we get the Western Bloc defined. "Sheba and Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, Art thou come to take the spoil? Hast thou assembled thy company to take the prey? To carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take great spoil? Well, some of those names might not be household names to us today, but they can mostly be identified, and I think all of them. The eastern bloc is headed here by Magog, of which the great Russians are the largest of the sub-tribes. Now, that includes quite a few people. There's the Samoyed peoples up in the north of Russia. There are the Uzbekis, the Kazakhs. Incidentally, the word Kazakh means free man. And there are the Mongols. In fact, Lamza, in his translation from the Aramaic, translates Magog as Mongolia. And the Mongols are another one of the sub-tribes, a major sub-tribe of the Massageti or Magog. And it includes the Yakut in eastern Siberia, and it includes the Koreans, the Eskimos, and the Aleuts. So now, first it's mentioned that they are the chief prince of Meshek and Tubal. Meshek is Armenia. And Tubal, well, they call themselves Kartavelians, meaning the rocks of Tubal. And Grugia, if you are a Slavic, and Georgia, if you are English. Now, those two tribes are already pretty much dominated by the Russians. The next surprise, though, comes with Persia. For 25 centuries, they were mortal enemies of the Russians. Ever since the Russians slew King Cyrus, the same King Cyrus we have mentioned in the scriptures. It only changed in 1989 when the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollah took power. Then there is Kush. Who is that? Well, that's Black Africa. And that's pending that we don't see Black Africa fully aligned with the Russians yet. Put, which is North Africa, about everywhere west of Egypt. And we have seen they're pretty much on the left these days, but it's getting more so that they seem to be getting friendlier with the Russians, more perhaps because of their hatred of elements of the West, including those that colonized them. Gomer. Well, Gomer was divided into three parts back in Genesis 10. And so the Gomer here will include the Germanic and Slavic tribes. Of the three tribes that came from Gomer, one was Ashkenaz. We still have that name, the Ashkenaz Jews, the Germanic Jews, Skanza in the name Scandinavia, and Ripeth. Well, we don't think of the Slavic peoples normally by the name of Ripeth, but their original homeland was the Carpathian Mountains, the Kara Ripeth, or the rocks or mountains of Ripeth. And Togarma is called out separately. That's Turkey and the other Turkic tribes. Not exclusively Turkey, because the original Turks went east. And that's why we have Turkestan today. And then they came back west and reconquered their original homeland, Turkey. They are in the process in this year, last year, and the year before, just in the last two or three years, they are already in the process of changing alliances from the west to the east. Now, perhaps the biggest surprise might be, why would the Germanic tribes be allied with Russia? They certainly weren't friendly during World Wars I or II. But there is a reason, a logical reason. Russia has plenty of resources, but they don't have the technology. Germany has the technology, but not the resources. And I think if one is watching the news as to what's going on between Germany and Russia, it's already started, just in small ways. But it may be an inevitable alliance. That's the Eastern Bloc. Now let's talk about the Western Bloc. It is headed by Sheba and Dedan. That's Arabia. We can demonstrate that another time. Followed by the merchants of Tarshish. That's westernmost Europe. At one time, many centuries ago, southwestern Spain was called Tartessus. And they established a colony on the northeast of the Mediterranean Sea, which is why Saul came from Tarsus, the one we call the Apostle Paul afterwards. So the merchants of Tarshish, that's westernmost Europe, the Celtic tribes or Celtic tribes, pronounced either way you like, Britain, France, Spain, Portugal, and so forth, with all the young lions thereof. That would be their former colonies, the Americas, maybe Australia and New Zealand as well. They are already allied with Arabia, but Arabia was mentioned first, that is Sheba and Dedan, then Tarshish, and the young lions thereof. That suggests that Arabia is going to be at the head of the Western Bloc. I used to think there must be some theoretical sense in which that's true. But already we see Arabia rising in influence in the West, do we not? There's already a cooperative trade arrangement in which the West buys the Arabian oil, and the Arabs buy our politicians. Now, one interesting note is that Elam, which is China, is absent from this list. It implies then that they may not be a major player in that, and if so, I guess that would be good for the Chinese health. But still, there will no doubt be some kind of involvement, because eventually all their lovers, all Israel's lovers, shall leave her. And of the Semitic tribes, the only ones mentioned are Israel itself and Sheba and Dedan. All of the others are non-Semitic. Now, what is the outcome of this? We get to, I think it's chapter 39, verse 6, where it says, I will send a fire on Magog, that is, the Eastern Bloc, and on them that dwell securely in the coastlands. That evidently is a picture of Armageddon, a prophecy of it. It mentions, I will send a fire on whom first? On Magog. That would suggest then that when the Eastern Bloc invades Israel and its immediate neighbors, that the West will respond with nuclear weapons against the East, and then the East will retaliate against the West, because these coastlands are mentioned later, or isles. But then the happy part of it is, after that's all over with, Ezekiel chapters 40 to 48 point to the temple and to the kingdom. Now, the important thing for you and for me is, what should we do? What is our appropriate role? Are we to go out with hammers and swords and try to fight against the bad guys? Well, we would have no power against them whatsoever, would we? So we want to know what it is we should do as well as what we should not do. Now, Habakkuk, gives us a picture. It gives us a pattern for our attitude at the present time. The message of Habakkuk chapter 1 is, why holdest thy peace when the wicked swalloweth up the man that is more righteous than he? In essence, what he's saying is, Lord Jehovah, I know that your people have sinned, but why do you let those who are less righteous than they are administer the punishment? It's a logical question, isn't it? In chapter 2, our Lord God responds, yes, I know, but woe to him. Or in other words, wait and see what happens to them. And finally, Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 17, tells us what our attitude should be. For though the fig tree shall not flourish, neither shall fruit be in the vine, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the fields shall yield no food, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in Jehovah. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Jehovah the Lord is my strength, and he maketh my feet like hinds' feet, and will make me to walk upon my high places. We know then approximately what's coming. We can figure out why it is coming. But we should be at peace, knowing that it is coming. But there's something afterwards, which is 9 chapters of Ezekiel's temple, or Christ's 1,000-year kingdom and the perfect ages of eternity. Now, further, what should we do? If we are in the harvest, then there are logical deductions from it. We should first preach this gospel of the kingdom in the whole world for a testimony unto all the nations, and then shall the end come. Are we expecting to convert the world? No. But we are expected to preach this gospel of the kingdom as a testimony unto all nations. And we can give comfort to the people because we can tell them, even though this world is going to pop, that afterwards there is something good, something that will restore all the years that the palmer worm and the other caterpillars have destroyed. This world will be replaced by a world to come in which dwells righteousness, and all that has been lost in the present evil world will be restored and then some. This is our message to the present evil world. Some people can live through, and they will be able to tell others, yes, this was foreknown, this is what was to be expected. Man isn't doing it by himself. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a testimony unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Is it a surprise, then, that we have something like the internet that couldn't have been imagined a couple hundred years ago? The truth of the kingdom is now available in every country in the earth. Some countries block it, but it's not because the signal isn't there. It is. Another thing for us to do. Come out of her, my people. That is, come out of Babylon, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Our motivation should be to not be partakers of the sins. But then we're also reminded that we be not partakers of her plagues. But let's keep in mind, too, Lot was called to come out of Sodom not once, but twice. He was called to come out of Sodom. He says, okay, but you know, this is awfully hard. Let me go to this little city here. This town is not very big. It can't be that sinful. So the Lord allowed that, but then he was required to leave that also after, I guess, he probably had a good night's sleep. And Elijah was called to come out of the city three times. What does this suggest for us? Well, 140 years ago, the brethren were called to come out of Babylon. They left many, many different denominations. And what happened when Brother Russell died? The call continued. Come out of Babylon, number two, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins. If we are not careful, that call will continue again. Come out of Babylon, number three, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins. We must be vigilant not to practice the sins of Babylon. Another thing, Israel is returning. It's according to prophecy. Think of the last verses of Amos. I will plant them again in their land, and they shall be no more plucked up out of their land, which I have given them, saith Jehovah thy God. He has put his name on it. What does that mean to us? We see all kinds of movements against Israel. And lying doesn't seem to be any restriction. That boycott, divest, and sanctions the BDS movement, and on college campuses, rallies against Israel. The lesson for us is, with the world making these bandwagons, we need to stay off that bandwagon. The Lord has a mission. It kind of reminds me of a sign that one fellow used to have. It said, either lead, follow, or get out of the way. And when the Lord is doing the leading of bringing Israel back to the land, we either follow, encouraging the Jews to go back to the land, or at least get out of the way and not be a hindrance. Today in the world, we have three major philosophies or spirits, if you want to call them that. We've got the hard right, that's ecclesiastical power. We've got the hard left, the atheists, on the other side, and then Islam as a third side. They are all hostile to Christ, and they are all hostile to Israel as well. We need to avoid all three. Now, one of the things we might consider is, are these three factions into which the world is strongly divided these days, do these correspond to the three unclean spirits of Revelation 16? I don't know about you, but I will be watching. None of them is anything that we should follow. Now, what are the consequences of what's happening? If leftist atheism and Islam are permitted to destroy Christianity, the world will not be able to blame Christ for Armageddon. That is our consolation prize. They're trying their foremost to destroy Israel, but we can know from the prophecies they will fail. After all, consider, what nation was it that helped Israel come out of Egypt at the time of the Exodus? Well, I guess you could say so. They were the opposition, but they really didn't help Israel. They prevented Israel from leaving up until they couldn't. But, yes. Do we think it's any different at the present time? If any nation had helped Israel to come out of Egypt, would they'd have taken the credit for it, wouldn't they? Instead, there was nobody to give the credit to except God himself. And so it is at this end of the age. When the time comes that not Canada, not the United States, not any other nation is for Israel, then when the Lord delivers Israel from the invaders, it will be evident there is no one that can be given the credit except God Himself. Just a little aside. Oops, forget that aside. Okay. So, especially if we are approaching a deep depression, there are things we should do. First, get out of debt. Second, stay out of debt. That's the best way to prepare for a deep depression if there is. A second, because of what's shown in Ezekiel chapter 10, verses 8 to 11, the threat is, you can all go, but let your youth be stayed behind. We should not neglect the youth at the present time and any potential new interest, for Satan is trying to stall it, divert it. Another, use what technologies we have now to preach the gospel while we still can, because a worldwide depression is likely to lead to worldwide tyrannies. And last, from Ezekiel, from Exodus 10:24 to 26, it suggests to us, let us sacrifice now while we are able, before that which we can sacrifice with is drained away during the depression. In conclusion, against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am Jehovah. Stand still and see the salvation of Jehovah, which He will work for you today.